Today is Thursday, May 16th, 2019. This is a part three Grand Canyon oral history interview with Bruce McAlay. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Bruce. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you?
Good, thank you. May we have your permission to record this oral history interview over the telephone?
Of course, sure.
Thank you so much. At the end of part two, you had graduated from Lubbock and had packed up and headed out to southern New Mexico to a small mountain town called Ruidoso, and that's spelled R-U-I-D-O-S-O, to work at a radio station. Can you pick that story up and carry on?
Pick it up there, okay. Yes, I ended up in Ruidoso by accident. You know, it's odd that sometimes small little turns on the trail can make such a big difference in your life, and this was one of them. And then also Grand Canyon was one of those small turns on the trail. But what happened was I went up there to go snow skiing on a weekend from college, and I walked into the radio station there and was just talking to the disc jockey, just being courteous and seeing what was going on. The owner came in and said, "You looking for a job?" I said, "Well, no, not really. I'm just passing through snow skiing." He said, "Well, I need a disc jockey." So I looked at the situation and I thought, boy, this would be a really fun town to live in. You know, snow skiing, horse racing in the summer, beautiful weather, beautiful country. So I took him up on the offer and I said, "I'll be out of school at this time and I'll move out here." And so I did that. Went to work for the radio station, and that didn't last long for one reason or another. We just didn't get along very well, and so I left that and went to work for a fellow that was producing a magazine. It was an advertising magazine for the area, and I ended up, we did everything. The two of us did everything there is to do with the magazine. We shot the photographs. We wrote the stories. We set the type, and we laid out the ads. Everything we did, and so I learned a lot about magazines, and did that for a while. But that job only lasted a few months until we produced the magazine, and there was nothing to do. So I'm, you know, working with all of the townspeople, all of the business owners for their advertisements, and they liked the pictures I was shooting. That's where I pretty much learned commercial photography, was doing that, and they would ask me to shoot photographs at their daughter's wedding, or come shoot pictures of the Little League football team, and pretty soon I'm making money doing that, and so that's what I did. I opened it was 2 years after I got to town. I opened a business, a commercial photography business. It was kind of tough. It's a small town. There's not as much work as you'd hope, but I got a lot of convention business because there was a couple of big convention hotels, and that helped. And pretty soon I was up and running. And the good news about it was I could shut things down and go to Grand Canyon, which I just couldn't stay away from. And between after I came back in 1973. I put in about 1,200 miles on the backcountry trails in Grand Canyon, but I always wondered where those rafts were going and what they were doing, and I'd talk to them from time to time.
Okay, wait. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
How big is Ruidoso, population-wise, at that time?
At that time, the population there was probably 7,000 people, but during the summer, the population swelled to about 50,000 people.
Wow!
And that was because of the quarter horse racing. It was the quarter horse racing capital of the world, and so all of those people came in: the grooms, the horsemen, the owners, the riders, the jockeys, their families. It all amounted to about 55,000 people in town through the summer. So it was a busy place. very busy place in the summer.
And also, I've got a question. You graduated from college with 2 degrees, and you didn't think, okay, well, I'm going to start a survey business and stay behind a transit and draw and get into that. You kind of uprooted and took off to see what would happen, you know, at the neighboring
yes.
state to the west. That was a big deal, I think.
A very big deal, yeah. I looked at the situation. I had been I went to work for a television station. I was a disc jockey in Lubbock for a while, and then I moved over to the television side of this one radio station, and I liked television. I really enjoyed it. I most enjoyed audio engineering, and that's pretty much what I did. And I went from there to doing, I started getting work as a freelance audio engineer for the big networks doing sporting events around the country. When you do that, you hire, they have to have these big video trucks that are moving all over the country, and they hire freelance technicians to man these trucks and to get the work done at the venue. So it's a pro football game or basketball, or could be soccer, any sporting event. And it's all live. It's all done live. And it was exciting to me. I loved the work, and I didn't want to sit in Dallas all my life doing engineering. That's what I was supposed to do. But I was having way more fun doing this audio engineering. It was exciting. I was traveling around and started traveling and seeing different parts of the country and meeting new and interesting people. And live television, let me tell you, that it's an adrenaline rush, that deal, because there's no do-overs. There's no multiple takes. Oh, we're going to take that scene again. You set up, and it's live television, and you have to get it right the first time, and it's a lot of pressure, I enjoyed it. I like the challenge of that, and still do. I still, once in a while, if I like what's going on and I like the people, I'll still go do audio for sporting events. Not much anymore, but... If I like the shoot and I like the people that are going, I'll do it.
Okay, I'm a little confused because the audio engineering, doing the freelance technical work, driving around, how did that stop and you drive to Ruidoso? I mean, why give that up to go out to, you know, southern New Mexico out near Roswell, and try to make a go of it there, leaving TV far behind?
Well, I didn't leave television. It doesn't matter where you live. It's the wrong place.
Oh.
As far as doing, if you're doing freelance television, you're not living where the venue is, except once in a while.
I mean, okay.
If you lived in Dallas, you would be working sporting events in Dallas when they came along. But for the most part, you're gone from home, no matter where you live. And I did that at the same time that I had a commercial photography company. I was doing both of those things.
Okay, got it. And then you mentioned, now this is 1973?
No, this is after 73. I moved to Ruidoso in about 1976.
Okay.
After I'd finished up college and made the move to Ruidoso.
And then you mentioned hiking in Grand Canyon.
Yes.
Besides your first hike down to the river and back, which you've already talked about, what was your next actual backpack in Grand Canyon?
Well, I went with something familiar. I hiked the Kaibab down and the Bright Angel up a couple of times because I knew I could do that. I knew there was help along the way and people and water, and did that. And then I hiked the North Rim Trail down to Phantom, and then I started hiking other trails I would go out and hike around Monument Valley and down to Pete's Creek and Deer Creek and you know, the big ones. And I hiked the Hance Trail, and I hiked one time. I hiked all the way down to Nankoweap. That's a hard, long hike. I really didn't realize how far that was.
So this was all in 76, 77, 78-ish, and you're driving back and forth from Redoso? Is that how that's working out?
Yes. I drive to Grand Canyon from New Mexico.
Okay, which would take a day, it would seem.
Oh, yeah, or more if I stopped along the way.
Okay, and then hiking in the late 70s, 77, 78, I'm assuming you had maybe an aluminum pack frame. What was your equipment like? What'd you carry?
Well, I still have this thing. When I was up north, when I was working at, you know, up in Seattle and Alaska, I wanted to start seeing the country, and I only knew how to do it by foot. I didn't know anything about river running or any of that. So I bought an REI cruiser pack back then, and it was an solid aluminum frame, and ultimately it didn't carry enough stuff, so I modified it. I sewed things onto it to make it into a bigger pack, and I still have it, and I still use it, in fact. That pack, I've repaired it many times. And both the material and the frame, I had to get frame re-welded once or twice. And I still use it on river trips. I'm so happy to have that thing. It's got a lot of great memories, and it still has high function for me. It's the pack that I use when I leave the boat to hike far up into the canyons with my photography equipment.
Nice.
It all fits in there with a little bit of food and water, and if I have to spend the night up in the canyon, I can if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I still have it, and it gets beat up so badly on these river trips. It just keeps going. You know, it just keeps going.
Very cool. Anything else, you know, did you that you could tell me about these early hikes into you know, Deer Creek and to Pete's Creek and Nankoweap? That's Nankoweap. These are off the beaten path hikes. What were
a
you
a little bit?
Yeah. You know, Bruce, hang on a second. There's somebody at the door. Hang on a second.
Oh, go. Yeah.
I'm gonna
sure,
put the
go
phone
ahead.
Down for
go
just
ahead.
A minute.
Yeah.
Rules of editing. That's all right, she says, I'll come back. I'm like, oh, for heaven's sakes, why did you come around in the first place? Never mind. Okay.
Okay.
So I was asking about Nankoweap and Deer Creek and to Pete's Creek. These are long journeys off the beaten path.
Yes, they are.
Did you see a lot of other people there?
No, I did not. At that time, hiking in Grand Canyon, there wasn't much pressure on it. I could get a permit anytime I wanted. I could walk up to the office and get a permit, which I always did. Sometimes I wandered away from that permit, but I always got one and hardly ever saw people, frankly. As time went on, Deer Creek became a hike that a lot of people do, and it was a loop hike from Monument Point. I would hike down, and one of the most beautiful places in the world is that plateau there. What are they? There's a word for what they call it in that area.
Oh, the Esplanade.
Yes, yeah, the Esplanade, and the Esplanade in that area is stunning. It's another world. It's beautiful. It's spectacular stuff, and you get to hike through this place. But it's no man's land because there's no water there. It's very hot unless you go in the wintertime. But the payoff is you get to the river. You get to Pete's Creek, and that's the payoff.
Yeah.
So at that time, I camped right there. As you hike down that last drop down into Deer Creek, there's a little flat spot there with a rock overhang, and that's where I camped. They won't let you do that anymore, but that's where I stayed, and it was a wonderful thing. And then if you hike down... Well, let's see. What did I do? I hiked down Deer Creek, and then I went up and over around Cogswell's Butte.
Yeah.
Which dropped me down to the river, and then it's just bouldering upstream until you get to Pete's Creek.
Okay.
So for me, that was a loop hike, I guess, and I would always do it that way. I would do it as a loop hike.
There's a fairly substantial trail that goes from the mouth of Tepetz Creek down to the Deer Creek patio that follows the river for quite a ways downstream from Tepetz Creek. At that time, when you made that hike, was there a route there at all, or was it just you just picking your way and there's no path at all?
I couldn't find any trail, and Lord knows I looked for one. There was a trail from the bottom of Cogswell's Butte as you approach the river for a little while. Then it petered out, and there's nothing. At that time, it was just bouldering, and boy, it'd be an easy thing to twist an ankle and be stuck there, and there'd be nobody to come down except there's always boats coming down. You could, I guess, flag down a boat if you got into trouble. Be the thing to do.
Do you remember who was issuing you permits in the permit office? Did you talk with them at all?
I don't have any recollection.
Okay.
I would just go over there and they would say, where do you want to hike? I'd tell them, they'd give me a permit, and I'd go away.
Okay. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, there was names, but I sure don't remember them.
Okay.
There was one backcountry ranger that I would run into at the Monument Point hike. I ran into him two times over about an 8-10 year period, and I forgot his name, but he was there for a while, and then I believe he went on. I think he was going to be a lawyer or something. I don't remember what his plans were in life, but anyway, he's a really nice fellow, and we would hike together for a while until he had to go somewhere else.
Nice.
Neat guy. And that's where I ran into river trips at Tepetz Creek all the time, and I ran into river trips at Deer Creek all the time. And they were the nicest people, those commercial outfitters. They would always ask me if I needed anything, and they would always take my trash for me. And if they were, having a meal there, I was always invited. It was always a real pleasure to run into the outfitters. They were so nice to me, and once in a while they'd give me a ride if I were trying to get from Deer to Pizza's down below Deer, right?
Other way around.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, they would give me, if I were there at the right time, they would give me a ride downriver.
Okay.
So that I didn't have to hike that bouldery trail, which I thought was very nice. I did that a couple of times. And so I got to ride on the raft and go through that real snaky area with all those strong currents.
Yeah, they're in Boulder, in the Granite Narrows above Deer Creek.
Granite Narrows. Yes. Oh, man, that was pretty neat. Those currents are real strong in there, and they was throwing their boats all over the place. And anyway, that was part of my hiking days. And so I really wanted to do that rafting thing, but, I had no experience at it. I didn't know anybody really. And I just I didn't really know how to approach that. I knew that it would be a great way to shoot pictures. A great way, because hiking cameras down into Grand Canyon, man, that's tough. Those trails are so long, it's hard enough just to carry the necessary food and gear just to get down the trail. I figured out that I wasn't going to be able to do a whole lot. I could only carry very small cameras, and it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to shoot pictures from this river trip venue, but I really never figured out or thought too much enough about it to do anything until 1981. And I thought, I need to try this. I need to see what I can do here. So I called the Park Service and asked them. I said, "How do I apply for work?" You know, they said, "Well, we'll send you a list of the companies that we license to do river trips. It's public information, and we'll send you that, and it will have the owner of the company and their phone number and their address where their company is located." I said, "Okay, thanks." So they sent me the information, and at that time, there were 22 different outfitters. And so I wrote a personal letter to each company's owner. I told them the truth, that I really want to run the river, but I have no experience, but I will do any job that you want if you will hire me. And then I followed up, I followed up those 22 resumes with a phone call. And that took a long time because they're, you know, trying to track these guys down was, it took a while to finally contact them all. And for the most part, it was, "No, we don't have anything. Thanks. Bye." Like, okay, go to the next one. And so nothing. I got no response, really. And in the meantime, I'm looking at the requirements, and boatmen that run Grand Canyon are required to have a medical certification. And I thought, well, maybe if I do that, at least I'll have one more thing toward the job. So instead of doing Red Cross Advanced First Aid, which is the minimum, went ahead and signed up for EMT, and that's a higher certification, of course. And I thought, it can't hurt. So I studied for 6 months to do EMT, and one of my instructors was a former guide with Sanderson.
Huh, who was that?
'70s. Let me think of his name. Don, I'll think of his last name here in a minute. And him and another guy that did maintenance at Lee's Ferry had both worked, you know, for commercial outfitters. And so I thought, oh gosh, great. You're a source of information. You've worked down there. So I'm pumping him, you know, through the whole course about this and that, and I'm learning the dictionary of all the words, you know, that the outfitter, you know, the River Runner dictionary, I'm trying to learn the words.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I got my EMT ticket, and I sent out 22 resumes again in, I think, 1982. And I think those guys got together and said, "Hey, somebody hire this guy so he'll quit bothering us." So then I started making phone calls. And I got a hold of a guy named Rob Elliott. And he said, "Look, you know, we really appreciate your tenacity here. But we, I can't hire you because you don't have any experience. So here's my recommendation to you. Go get a job on the Green River or some lesser river and get a year or two at that, and then come back and talk to me. Then you'll have a much better chance." And I said, well, okay, thanks. And so at any rate, I called all of these guys again on the phone, and in the mail, I got two job offers, to my amazement. One offer was with Hatch River Expeditions, and they were based in Vernal, Utah at the time. And the other one was Canyoneers, and they were in Flagstaff. So I thought, okay, I'm going to follow up on this. So I called both of them, and I said, I'm going to make a trip in the wintertime, and I'm going to come talk. And they said, well, yeah, we need to have a sit-down before we can hire you, of course. So the first easiest place to get to was Canyoneers and Flagstaff. And if that didn't work out, I was going to continue driving from Flagstaff to Vernal, Utah, and talk to to Ted Hatch, who was the guy that I needed to talk to. So I went there to Canyoneers, and I talked to Gaylord, and he hired me right there. He said, here's the problem that I have. A lot of the people we hire are college students. They can't come early enough to start the season, and they can't stay late enough to end the season. If you would agree to come when I open the shop and then stay until I close the shop, I'll hire you. And I said, sure, I'll do that. I will.
So this is Gaylord Stavely.
Yes,
S-T-A-V-E-L-E-Y. What do you remember about that first visit with Gaylord? How did he strike you? Is he a short man, tall man, older, younger? What struck you about him?
Well, he's an interesting guy. He's tall. He's about 6 foot something, silvery hair, just pure silver hair by that time, really a very nice guy. He's quiet and understated, but he has a depth of experience in that part of the country that is unbelievable. But you kind of have to pull it out of him. He's written a book or two.
Mm-hmm.
So of course I read his books, and I said, "Yeah, Gaylord, I read your book." And when I had time or he had time, I'd ask him about stuff now and then. But he was a real interesting guy, and he was most eager to teach me how to get things done in the shop, because that's what he hired me for. He didn't hire me to run the river, and I told him, I said, look, I'm not here to necessarily run the river. I just want to get close to it, and whenever you feel like, you know, I can maybe go down there and learn the river part of it, that's what I'd like to do. In the meantime, I'll do whatever you say here in the shop. I'm pretty handy with tools. I can work on outboard motors. I can fix things, and I can learn to weld if you'll teach me, whatever, you know. So that's the way it went. And in between myself and Shane Murphy, we pretty much kept those boats running.
So was Shane working for Gaylord when you showed up?
Yes.
Okay. What do you remember about Shane?
I liked the guy. We got along well. I was a hard worker on the river, and all the guys always appreciated that. And him and I were friends. I used to go out to his. He had a place, man, way out in the middle of nowhere, and his daddy was an author. He always wanted to be, but he never really wrote anything worth publishing, I guess. He was kind of a frustrated writer, but he was a good river runner, and he knew all the stories. Everyone has different stories, and he had great stories down there, and he was good with the passengers, and I thought he was good with his boatmen as well.
At this point, had Gaylord switched from the regular 36-foot-long big rubber motorboats to the giant Canyoneer's rig. Yeah. So that change had been made already?
That change had already, I had never seen the smaller rigs.
Okay.
I only knew the 40 footers.
Okay.
20 passengers, 3 crew. That was the trip. Very big boats, really monstrous boats.
And they were running,
hard to drive.
They were running, launching on Sunday, one exchange trip and one through trip, is that right? Two trips launching on Sunday? What was that schedule, do you remember?
They did launch on Sunday. Sunday to Sunday was their schedule. It was a tight schedule, really tight. They would launch on Sunday. They would take out on Sunday from Scorpion Island. Our last night in Grand Canyon was on Scorpion Island.
Right above Pierce Ferry there.
Yes, and it was a 10-minute drive over to Pierce. Trucks were there. We de-rigged. The buses would take the people away, and we would get the boats on the trailer, drive them back to Flagstaff, fix them, re-rig them, put new food on it, and drive that same rig on Sunday. This all happens, the turnaround happens in one day, a whole thing. It drives out of there at about 6 in the evening or 7 in the evening back to Lee's Ferry. So that boat goes from Pierce Ferry, gets re-rigged, fixed, new food, cleaned up, and it's back at Lee's Ferry that evening. An amazing turnaround.
Okay.
And it didn't matter if it were a 2-day, 4-day split, that's what that was, or a full 7-day trip. They all launched on Sunday and came home on Sunday. That's how he worked it.
So the trips actually launched from Lee's Ferry on Monday morning, but they needed to be back at Lee's that night, Sunday night, to pick up the passengers in the morning on Monday. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I think that's how it would have to happen. It was either that or we came back on Saturday night and launched on Sunday. I can't remember. I think it might have been that we returned on Saturday night and launched on Sunday. I believe that's correct. Because his launches were on Sunday.
Okay.
And I was always up at, well, I should go back to the shop. So I'm working and fixing things and getting pretty good at fixing his motors, which he needs. And I can actually, you know, straighten props out without having to throw them away. And I'm doing pretty good and things are going along fine. I'm a good employee. Everything's good. Everything's fine. And when something came up, one of the boatmen was out of pocket, either sick or had something, and he couldn't find a regular replacement. You know, normally he would be able to call one of the other boatmen, you know, that wasn't going down the river at the time, but it wasn't there. And so he said, "Hey, Bruce, I need somebody to go down the river. Can you go?" I said, "Absolutely." So I went on my first river trip, with a guy named Chris, a Mormon kid out of Utah, I can't remember his last name, and went down there and just had the time of my life. It was a lot of work, of course, and came back, and I got a good report from the other boatman, and he put me on the river. That's what he did.
So
the first year...
Let's go back to this. So Chris is driving, and you're the term I believe is swamping, S-W-A-M-P-I-N-G. So you're hanging out on the boat, and then you pull the camp, and you help set up the kitchen and help set up the bathroom. Is that kind of how that was going then?
Yes. Mm-hmm. On the trips where it wasn't split, in other words, it was, you know, straight through 6 days, no split up. There were 3 crew on the boat. If it was a 2-day, 4-day split, you only had 2 people on the boat, 2 crew on the boat for the first, 2 days. And then the third boatman was the one that hiked the people down the trail from Bright Angel down to the beach, and then you picked up your third boatman at Phantom or Bright Angel, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
At the boat beach, and now you had a full crew at that point. So it was a little harder work, actually, on the two-day, four-day split on the top part, because
uh-huh.
there's only two boatmen doing everything instead of three. So you get it done. Sometimes you go a little later into the evening because of it, but no one seemed to mind. It was fine.
So this is you launch on Sunday. You've got Sunday night and Monday night, and then Tuesday morning you're at Phantom Ranch, is that right?
Yes.
So that's 86, 87 miles in two nights, 3 days.
Right.
Okay. So you're boogieing along.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then at Phantom, was it a full exchange? Everybody walked out, new people walked in, or did just a couple people go? How did that work out?
Most of the time on the two-day, four-day split, there were very few people on the two-day part, because the real good part of the trip was down below. You got the big rapids, you got Deer Creek, you got Havasu, all the good stuff is down below Phantom. And so they sold seats on the two-day part of it for cheap, because they could never fill the boat up. Never did that happen. If you got, it could be anywhere from 4 to 8 people on the boat, and then you picked up all those hikers that came down, and now you got 20. And sometimes the two-dayers would walk out, and sometimes they would go the whole way. But mostly they were gone. Mostly they were gone.
And did you double camp with the 6-day trip? Because it sounds like you got two trips. They both launch the same day. They both take out the same day. Kind of more or less running on the same schedule, except one stops at Phantom and the other one doesn't.
We were independent trips, and sometimes there was a problem at Phantom, or sometimes there was a delay on the 6-day trip, so you wouldn't join up. But if you were at the beach at the same time, rewatering, you might make a plan to double camp.
Okay.
Because it was good for the boatmen to do that, because now you have 6 boatmen taking care of one beach, and man, I think your workload goes way down, and you get things done a lot faster, and it was good to do that. I liked it, but we didn't do it that often. It was legal.
Were these one boat trips or two boat trips, or did it depend?
Oh, it sometimes. We would run a two-boat trip that was all the way, 6 days all the way, no split. Sometimes he would do that. I never really figured out that schedule. But, yes, sometimes we stayed together for the whole trip.
Okay. But most of the time it was just one boat on the 6-day or one boat, 2-4 to Phantom.
That's right. Yeah,
okay.
That's the way that it. There was no rhyme or reason to it, really. It's just sometimes there were two Canyoneer boats together, and we'd camp.
Okay.
And then sometimes we'd split up. We'd camp together for a night or two, or and then we would say, well, we've already done this. We're going to go do that instead. And it was up to the trip leaders, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they allowed it back then. They allowed the camping of, 20, 40, 46 people on a camp. And one time, we came around the corner, and there were 8 hatch boats on a beach, river left, I can't remember it. It's a huge beach, and there were 8 boats there. And I went, oh, my God, are you kidding?
Wow.
what an impact. So I asked Mark Law about that. He said, well, yeah, it was a special deal, and we gave him special permission to do it. It was some politicians were on a trip or something. I don't remember. But I hope they don't still do that.
Okay. So this was in 82, 83. Now, at that time, the water got kind of high there in 83. How did that work out?
My first trip down there was 83,000 cubic feet per second. It was a mill race through Grand Canyon. And my first run with the company of Lava Falls, the water was 83 and rising. And the shelf at Lava Falls wasn't a shelf anymore. It was this great, big, grand, glassy, green wave. It was spectacular. And we drove right over the top of that thing because that was the best way to run the rapid at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the tail waves down below were just monstrous. They didn't quit. The waves they were so big. You know that cheese grater rock on the right-hand side? There's another wave or two after that rock, and it's over. Not then, not that day. The waves were monstrous for 100 yards down below there, maybe further. It was unbelievable.
Hmm.
I thought that was normal, you know. I didn't know any difference. And other places, most of the rapids were gone. Badger and Soap Creek were just kind of riffles, little bit of bumps to it. Hance was a monster. Crystal was just stupidly dangerous. It scared everyone to look at it. It was horrible. It was horrible. We did the spin run around it, and this guy was good. He knew how to spin that boat around at Crystal, and we missed the big wave and all the trash.
So how did you do that? Would he actually turn the boat 180 degrees around so he's motoring upstream? And kind of
he used momentum to move that boat out of the way of Crystal, and so he's got a fairy angle coming into the tongue of it, and if you go into the tongue, you're going into that monster hole. That's how it is. And so he gets into the V waves on either side of the tongue, on the right hand V, you know, the V going in, and he starts over on the left, and he starts moving right and times it so that he has maximum speed. He breaks that wave, that V wave going in, and before he gets to the hole, he just cranks it around and the tail end just spins fast and spins all the way around backwards in it. Now the tail is kind of, now we're backwards. But the boat is the momentum of that moves the boat well off to the right of the wave.
Okay.
And he immediately pulls the motor out of the water because we're in shallow water over there on the side. He knew what to do. So he spun it around and we're out of danger. He pulls the motor up, jackassed the motor up, and then he would kind of tilt it whenever he'd see a rock. And we drifted on down and got back into deep water. And you got to make a decision again pretty quick about which way you're going to go from Big Red. And so when he got deep water, he put the motor back in and starts motoring back against the current. And we pulled into the beach right below the rapid. That's how good he is. And we stopped, and everybody was fine. Everything was good. We watched another boat or two come through. And then turned around and ran the right side.
Okay,
which
so
at that time,
I was just thinking to describe this rapid a little bit. There's a fairly large and terrifying water feature, a hole at the top, and then so you're your run is off to the right side of that hole, a turnaround run, and then back down. The jackass is a tool to lift the engine up out of the water. So if there's a rock and you're going backwards, you don't crush the engine on that rock. And the jackass worked with a big bar, and you'd pull that bar up and it would lift this hinge arrangement, pick the whole engine up. And then Big Red is a rock on an island below the rapid, and you had to go to the right or to the left around that rock island. Is that right, explaining all that?
Well, that's correct. I didn't explain that to you, but yes, that's part of the danger of Crystal, is the rock island down below, and Big Red is the rock that's right at the top of that, you know, rock bar.
Okay.
And you got to go one side or the other of it. The jackass actually doesn't lift the motor out of the water. It lifts it about 3 inches higher is all that it does.
Okay.
It's a big bar that you have to use a lever, a long lever. So it's just a big, long bar that's right there at the hands of the boatman, and he can lift that motor at any time. So what you do is, you know, if you think you're in danger, you lift it up, you get your 3 or 4 inches, and then if you're still in danger, I mean, your prop is still in the water. You can maneuver the boat even though you have it jackassed up.
Okay.
And if it's even worse than that, then you, while you're holding it up, then you just grab the motor and tilt it
and get
it out of the way. You physically tilt it and get it away from that rock is what you do. And it's all part of the process. And learning how to use that, when to use that, that's part of the finesse of running one of those motor rigs.
And these were two-stroke motors. Were they fairly quiet or fairly loud? What was that like?
Fairly loud. They're outboard engines. They're two-strokes. Ours were Mariners. 30 horse is what we used because one person could carry a 30 horse theoretically. 40 horse was the limit. That was the legal limit, but no one wanted to lift a 40 horse. They were too heavy, except for Ben. Big Ben could lift them. But the rest of us couldn't lift those things without help. But you could lift 30 horse, and that's what we used. And boy, I'll tell you, it's hard to move a Canyoneer boat, as long as they are, with a 30 horse motor. You had to make your decisions well ahead of time.
Okay. All right, so this is 1983, and then what happened?
Well, I fell in love with rafting. So I did my work and did as good as I could, so they'd ask me back, you know, to go. The guides would, you know, ask me back. And so I got back, and Chris, you know, told Gaylord that I'd done a good job. And so Gaylord put me on the river, knowing that I was going to stay after it was over to help repair all of the gear and to tear it down and to put it to sleep for the winter. So that I ended up doing 5 or 7 trips that first year, one a week. I was busy all the way. I didn't have a week off. I just kept going.
What was your pay at the time? Do you remember?
It was as the third man, I was started out at $75 an hour, or $75 a trip, and then if you're the second man up, you get $85 a trip, and then if you're a trip leader, you get that varied. It could be anywhere from like 95 to 125 a day. It's about what it was running.
And then that would be plus tips at the end of the trip?
Yes, and sometimes we got big tips. And the other thing was, as I got going down there, I'm making friends with the passengers and treating them really well. And so we're getting these big tips. Anytime I was on a trip, we were getting big tips. And the boatmen were going, well, you can send Bruce down because his trips always get big tips, you know. And so there was that going on at the company. Take Bruce. Tips are bigger. So
why weren't the other trips' tips as good? Were they not interfacing with the passengers?
Yes, they were. But I don't know the difference. I don't know why my trips were getting bigger tips. I don't have an explanation for
it. I mean, do you think you're just a good people person? And that you know, certain could make a difference.
I spend time with them, and maybe the other boatmen don't spend as much time. I don't know. I just enjoyed the customers. I enjoyed the people coming down there. They're from all over the world, and they have interesting stories themselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not just us boatmen. Yeah, we live and work down there, and you know, we know the ropes and everything, but these people have stories. You know, they have interesting stories too. Let me tell you one. We had the captain of the aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise, and he's on the flag track to Admiral, and he came down on the river trip with us, and he brought us all an official hat from the USS Enterprise.
Wow.
Said that, and it said VIP on it, and this was the hat that they gave to the press whenever the press was on the ship doing a story. They gave him a VIP hat so that everybody know who they were, and he gave us this hat, and we're having a great time. And we got stuck one day. This was a Shane trip. Me and Shane were on this trip, and Shane got stuck on a sandbar overnight, and we got up in the morning and the boat isn't floating, and it's like, ah, God. So we got as much gear off the boat as we could, and we got everybody up early to start pushing and pushing, because Shane did not want the other commercial boatmen to see that we had gotten stuck. That's embarrassing. So, you know, by 7 o'clock in the morning, we're floating again, and we went back to breakfast. And we go down the river a ways after getting unstuck, and I said to the captain, the skipper of the Enterprise, I said, so what would happen if the Enterprise were grounded? And he got this serious look on his face all of a sudden, and he says, well, court-martial to start.
Wow.
And your career, it would be a career-ending event. And listen to this. 6 months later, I read in the newspaper that the USS Enterprise had grounded in Puget Sound near the submarine base at Bremerton. And I always wondered if it was that skipper of the boat that came down with this.
Huh.
And if it was true, his career was over.
Yeah, yeah.
So stories like that, if you talk to passengers, you find out interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was this fella, Mike. He was 80 years old. He moved around like he was 60, and he was down there with his new bride of 75, and they were on this river trip, and Mike seemed not to be very concerned at all with this whitewater. He had no fear of it, and so I asked him one day. I said, "Hey, Mike, have you done this before? Have you done whitewater?" He goes, "No, but I'm no stranger to adventure." I said, "Yeah, well, like what?" He said, well, I was on the two Admiral Byrd expeditions up to Antarctica.
Wow.
And so I thought, there's no story we've got that could compare to that.
Yeah.
And so instead of us telling stories around the campfire at night, we had Mike tell us stories about Antarctica. And the one that stuck with me was... the Admiral had his right-hand man was a hard-driving, hard-drinking guy, and whenever he had a problem, he would come into the Admiral's office and sit down with his bottle of whiskey and pour himself a shot and douse a quick one, and then tell the Admiral his problem. Well, he came in one day, and he stored his bottle of alcohol right there at the door. Well, I guess he forgot, and the alcohol was exposed to the minus 80 degree temperatures and was that cold. And he poured himself a shot of liquor and sucked it right down, and then he fell over dead on the admiral's desk right there.
Wow.
Just dead right there. And what happened was that minus 80 degree alcohol, it hit his throat and esophagus and froze it, and he suffocated right there in front of the admiral. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a hell of a story there, Mike. You know, his stories were way, way far better than ours, I thought. There was a million of those stories. That was a big deal, that whole Antarctica thing.
Yeah.
A pretty big deal. So that's the kind of people that you're going to get. And if you don't talk to them, you're never going to know.
Right, right.
You never know.
So where did you stay in Flagstaff for that spring, summer, and fall?
Well, Gaylord had a house that him and Joy had lived in out in Doney Park. It's kind of a horse area. And not far. It's about 5 miles out of Flagstaff, heading down the road for Lee's Ferry, whatever highway that is. And most of the boatmen lived there. She charged us, $50, $60 a month and give us a bedroom there. Had a bunch of bedrooms in it. And that's where I'd live.
Okay, so that was a nice deal for them, because they would pay you money and then they'd get the money back for room and board, and that, or for room anyway.
Yes,
All right.
It was a good deal for everybody.
Uh-huh.
We really liked it. It was cheap and really nice and quiet out there. It was a great place. I liked it. And some of the boatmen had campers, like on the back of their pickup, and Gaylord would let them set those up, back in the yard somewhere where you couldn't be seen, because I don't believe the zoning restrictions would allow that. But he let them do it anyway, and that worked out real good for them.
Mm-hmm.
They had they had their camper or whatever, and they could just bring it to Canyoneers to work for the summer, and they wouldn't have. Still with me?
Yeah. Sorry.
Something happened, and they wouldn't have to pay rent. It was a good deal.
Okay.
A good deal for them.
All right.
But anyway, Canyoneers was a great place to work. I just have the highest regard for Gaylord Stavely. He's a stand-up guy.
Nice.
He always does what he says. He's pretty quiet. If you want anything from him, you have to ask. And so we flipped a boat in Crystal one year, and it was a harrowing event. We were so lucky that we didn't have any drownings on that, and I was pretty shook. Everybody was pretty shook.
How did that happen, and when was that? What was the story there?
Well, let's see. Marty was driving. Doesn't matter. It could have been me, but we were running left that year at Crystal. I don't know why people just decided to run it left, and so we ran it left, and he was a little too far left, and there is that wall on the left. And you need to get away from that. You need to either hit it, nose first, and it'll send you right up the side of it real violently. But it'll suck the tail around, and then you'll be off of it. But if you hit it sideways, it's going to pin you.
Well, it'll just roll you over, wouldn't it? I mean, it'll just act as a ramp and flip you over?
It did. We ended up there sideways. Marty tried to run from it. He had a choice. He could either nose into it or run from it. and he decided to run from it, and we just barely edged up onto it. The boat stopped, and then it went forward about 10 feet. We thought we were out of there. The boat stopped again, and then boom, in a microsecond, that boat is upside down.
Wow. And this is a big boat. It's the biggest boat on the river.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So now we got 23 people in the water, and the rapid's really not over yet. So people are looking at me, and, you know, what do I do? And, man, I get over here. Get to the boat if you can. And then we came down below the rock bar, finally washed down. We could hear the boat scraping on the rocks as we went toward Big Red. And if there was anybody under there, they would have gotten cut in half immediately. Anyway, we got down below there in calm water, and the other motor rigs up top had seen what happened, so they didn't scout. They immediately ran down to their boat. So the boat eddied out down below, and some people, I told them to swim to shore because that was closer, and some people, I had them come to the boat, and it was real tight for when the boat stopped, sort of, at Big Red there. There was a real heavy lady that was hanging onto a strap. Her and I and her husband were hanging onto a strap on the outside, on the left side of the boat. Big Red's on the right side of us. And the boat slowed down, and the current grabbed her and started pulling her under. And she wouldn't have made it. So to stop her, I grabbed her life jacket, and her husband is horrified, and I said, told him, you grab her life jacket. And so the two of us held onto her and holding ourselves so that we don't get sucked under. And anyway, we kept her from going under. Her head was just barely still above the water, and then it let us go. And then when it lets you go, then you're not fighting current anymore. So there was somebody on top of the boat now, upside down boat, and we said, help us get her up. So we got her up on top first because she was in the most danger. Then we got her husband up, and then we got me up, and then a few others, and the boat eddied out. The other motor rigs came down and pushed us into an eddy on the left, and that's where we ended up. And so we got on the a helicopter. The word got out. Everybody got on their radios, and a chopper came. We had five medicals. The worst was a laceration. A young boy had a long laceration on the back of his leg. That was the worst of it. We treated him and treated the others. We had some concussions and broken bones and lacerations. And so the park took the medicals out one at a time, and then once the medicals were out, then they were transferring two or three people out at a time. And by the end of the afternoon, and the trip leader broke his wrist, so he had to go. So it was just me and the other boatman on this beach with this upside down whale, wondering what in the hell just happened here. What have we done? Oh my God. And it just kind of started sinking in, man. It was like, oh man, this is trouble. This is terrible. So anyway, we fished some food off the boat and found a couple of dry bags off the boat. Everything was wet, but at least we knew there'd be a sleeping bag in each one. Didn't matter, it was sopping wet.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we just stayed the night. We cooked weenies. We had, you know, we found some weenies and a couple things. Water was the biggest problem. Well, next morning, just about first light, here comes the park in a helicopter, and they're there to reflip this boat. And at the same time, Shane launched an empty Canyoneer boat at Lee's Ferry the next morning, and he drove all the way to Crystal and got there at about 3 in the afternoon with everything, you know, supplies, fuel, extra motors, anything that Gaylord thought we might need for this flip. And the park had no idea, no one had any idea how to reflip that boat. And they brought down a gadget called a rope puller. And this is basically a come-along, same idea, except that instead of pulling a 10-foot cable through it, it pulls a rope through it. As long as the rope is, it'll just keep pulling it for as long as you have a rope.
And that's
what they brought, along with a few hundred feet of static caving line.
Just one rope puller?
That's right.
Okay.
To reflip a 12,000-pound rig. And we didn't know if it was going to work. Nobody did. They didn't know. So we start cranking on it, and it gets to be hard, hard work. We take turns pulling that thing, one hard click at a time. And the caving line went from about 14 millimeter. It was stretched so tight that it went down to 6 or 7 millimeters. It was like scary. This thing, if it snaps, it's going to take somebody's head off.
Mm.
So I stopped and I said, "Hey, wait, this is dangerous, don't you think?" And they said, "Yeah, it is, but we got to, what else can we do?" I said, "Well, let's tie some life jackets and some cushions and stuff onto that rope so that if it snaps, maybe we'll just get hit in the face with a life jacket instead of a rope." And they said, "Yeah, okay." So as we were lifting it, all this stuff drifted out from under the boat, and we had plenty of it. So we tied life jackets on the whole run. So if it did snap, the life jackets would slow it down. And anyway, the thing finally, you know, it took, 8, 12, 6. Well, we cranked on that rope for 6 hours, finally got it up level, and we just pulled it over onto the beach, and it slammed down, and we looked at the damage, and it was unbelievable. It just tore that rig to pieces. It wrecked it. So we didn't have the outrigger tubes were toast. They were so full of rips that they were not fixable. And so we had to drive it out of there without the outrigger tubes. We salvaged what we could.
How did you get the boat off the beach back in the water?
How do we do that? Well, the tide was coming and going. I think tide came up.
Okay.
I think we had tide help.
All right.
Refloated it when the tide came up. And this was in the day of really big tide swings. Real big tide swings. I remember this thing called Holiday Low Water in Grand Canyon. And they would turn it down to 3,500 cubic feet per second. Well, that's nothing. That's no water. You know, trying to get a Canyoneer rig through Hance at 3,500 was just absurd.
Mm.
And they would do that. 3,500 cubic feet per second. So it would run. My recollection is the water ran from... And you had weekend low water as well. It would run from like 4,500 up to 35,000. 4,500 to 35,000 in one day.
Okay.
And that's a big jump, man.
So would they crank it up that much in the morning and then turn it down that much at night? Would it be just like this giant swing?
Yes,
okay.
And it was fast. They ramped it up and down. It went from 4,500 to 35,000 in an hour,
okay.
Or maybe two. And so the Canyoneer trip was designed to catch high water on certain parts of the trip to get them down there, as you know, to get them through stretches of white water that the Canyoneer boats couldn't do if it were low water.
Okay.
And so the whole Canyoneer schedule was built around the flow regime. And boy, you didn't want to get your boat caught in the low water part. That'd be bad. Georgie was the same way. Her boats were even bigger. She couldn't run that low water. There was no way.
So Georgie's boats weren't as long, but they were definitely wider because she had three rafts tied together. Three 32-foot donuts tied together, side by side.
The G-rings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I ran into her one day. I was camped at down below.
Hey, Bruce, before we go to Georgie's stories, which I definitely want to capture, let's finish off this. This boat has just been turned right side up there at Crystal.
The flip. I'm sorry, I got distracted.
Yeah. And then what happened? How did you got to get that boat out of there? You got to get a motor on it and run it out.
Well, we drove the two boats together. Shane drove an empty Canyoneer rig down, and I was driving the torn up boat.
What about Marty? So he flew out because he broke his hand?
He flew out. Okay. Yeah, he broke a wrist. He had to go out, and so if the boat drives pretty good without the outrigger tubes on it, and you have no passengers, and most of the gear had been ripped off of it, so it was pretty lightweight.
Were you finding gear downriver as you cruised along? Say, oh, that's one of our bags there, and grab it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The cannon is littered with stuff. Life jackets and cushions mostly, but parts. It broke up the superstructure and ripped off the two big coolers up there. So there's food floating, pieces of got cooler, things like that, and you know, we pick up as much as we can find, of course.
Uh-huh.
So we drive and drive, and we got out of there. I think it took us 2 days to get out of there. Yeah, about that. Then the trucks were there to pick us up, haul us back, and you know what? That rig. That rig was a total loss. All of the cars, all of the gear, the rigging, the inner tube was salvaged. The outrigger tubes were thrown away, and all of the cars and the rigging had to be thrown away.
I'm sorry, the cars?
Yeah, the way most of the motor rigs work is they have these cars. I call them that. They're frame members, but they have a floor in them and sides and handlebars and seats. And each car has, you know, four rows of seats. And then you use a crane or whatever, and you drop these cars down in between the tubes. You know, the inner tube is open down the middle.
Uh-huh.
And so you drop those cars down in between the tubes and lash them down to the cars down to the tube, and then you put another car in, and then you join the two cars. Actually, Canyoneer had three cars, and you would join the cars with a pivot pin on each side. So at each point of contact, there's a pivot pin on each side of the car, left to right, and what that allowed it to do is the cars could pivot at that point.
Right. So the whole thing was kind of articulating up and down a little bit, but it was pinned so you couldn't get your fingers in there, which was good.
You could.
Oh.
You could. And we built as much safety into that as we could to keep people, you know, we said you cannot sit here, you cannot lay anything down here at the pivot points. We had them covered as best we could, but you couldn't cover them completely.
Okay.
And for the most part it worked. No one ever had a problem. But one day this one guy, he just wouldn't follow instructions. He wouldn't do much of anything we told him on the whole trip, as in fact. He had his own mind about what he was going to do, and no one was going to tell him what to do. So he was sitting there, and we went over, it wasn't even a big rapid, we went over something, and the boat, you know, does its little caterpillar thing up and down over the wave. He had his hand in there, and it took off a finger. And so now we have to pull over, and we found the severed finger and put it on ice, hoping maybe they could put it back on or something. Got him choppered out of there, and we heard later that they were not able to reattach his finger.
Mm-hmm.
It was too jagged of a cut or something, and they couldn't reattach it. So, yeah, I think things like that happen. I think any motor rig company is going to have stories like that. It's just that way. Georgie, unfortunately, had more of those stories than most of the rest of us, bless her heart. But those rigs are not terribly safe. They're safe as you can make them, but still, it's a big river, and they are whitewater rafts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get hurt down there. I don't care what kind of boat you have. I always admired those two guys that jumped in the river, those two insurance guys from California, surfer fellows, and floated down the river. And they don't even have a boat, and they were getting beat up. Their own boxes would beat them up from time to time. Doesn't matter what you have. You can have an incident down there. It's just the nature of the trip. It's high adventure. It's also dangerous.
Indeed.
There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do to remove all of the danger.
Right.
And that's part of the lure.
Well, we've been yik-yakking this for about an hour and 20 minutes here, and I wonder if this is a good place to wrap this part 3 up. Is there anything else you'd like to run to talk about this particular boat flip and its recovery and aftermath?
Well, I learned to have a greater respect for the other boatmen on the river.
Hmm.
When there's an incident like this, everyone comes together and does the best that they can. And all of the other commercial boatmen were right there at the ready. Anything we needed, they were there to help us, and they did too. And I can't say enough about the commercial boatmen on the river in Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
They will help you. They're not selfish at all. They're out there to help. We're all in the same boat together, as it were. And you have to help each other out down there. Everyone does, whether you're a commercial boatman or a non-commercial boatman. It's a big place. Things can and do go wrong, and it doesn't matter what hat you wear. When there's a need, the boatmen come together and get the job done.
Nice.
So the Cannoneer flip, it finished out. We ruined the boat. It was part of the business. I thought maybe we were going to get fired or something. I didn't know. When I got back, Joy and I don't generally get along. That's Gaylord's wife. But she's all business, and she came to me as soon as I got off the river from the flip, and she came to me, and she says, Bruce, you saved her life. You saved that woman's life. You're a hero. They think you're a hero. We think you're a hero. And that set me back. I wasn't ready for any title like that. I just did my job. That's it. I did what I thought was right. I was trying to save my own life. I was trying to save theirs. And we did. We didn't lose a soul. And normally, when motor rigs flip, somebody dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's how it is. That was my fear. That was my worst fear. And it didn't happen for us. We were so lucky. Everything worked out for us, and we didn't have any deaths. Anyway, they didn't fire us, and we kept on working. And people corresponded with us after that trip. The passengers said they thought we just did a great job about taking care of business after the incident, and they were, you know, glad that we were on their trip and things like that. And,
cool.
And it was a bad time, but there was some lessons to learn, and that's what I take home with me, is the good things that I learned about boating from the incident, and what to do in the future if something like that happens, what to do better or different. And, you know, it's just a learning experience, and that was a good one.
Yeah, I'm really impressed that one little rope puller could tug that boat over. That's pretty good.
Well, as it turns out, that thing, I looked at that and I went, oh my gosh, what a great tool. And I purchased one to use on these solo raft trips, because I cannot by myself reflip the boat. And however, with that rope puller, I know that I can. And I think one year I sent that thing out to you to use. And,
you did, and we were very grateful for it.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't have to use it.
We didn't, but it rode with us, and we were glad to know that if we needed it, it was there. We ran it on the outside of the boat, so that if the boat was over, we could get to it, and it was pretty simple.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, it's peace of mind is what that and other gear. Those are just little things that you have for peace of mind, and you know, the whole thing down there, a lot of it is confidence. And if something goes wrong and you lose your confidence, you're not going to get it back, and things are going to keep going wrong for you. And you know, when you can have little things like that, it keeps your confidence higher, and that is so important on a river trip.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So,
well, let's call it good here for
okay.
Does that sound
right.
Anything
so,
else?
Remind me.
For part three here?
No, I just want to remember so that when we can kind of start here next time.
Yeah,
we'll start.
We'll talk about it in a minute. So I think we'll go ahead and conclude. This is end of part three, Grand Canyon Oral History with Bruce McAlay. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Thursday, May 16th, 2019. Bruce, thank you very much.
Tom, thank you. Had a good time.